I just realized that Trevor is a fish.
Yeah, of some kind.
Is it a
squid? I think it's a squid.
Oh, it's a
shrimp? A carp?
It's a bristlenose plecostomus.
I can't believe you didn't know that, Gabriel.
That's exactly what I was gonna. Yeah.
In tech we trust. Charge we're not sure about.
Okay, so episode 48, and first of all, can I apologize for the shenanigans of last week? We were hacked. It was a riot. It was very un-British. It's just not allowed to have fun. I don't know what was going on. No, brilliant show last week. If you haven't listened to episode 47, the VDB takeover, go back and listen to last week. Cracking show. Hours away, Gabriel hosted the show, showed me how it should be done. It was a riot. It was brilliant. Well, you were there, Mark, right? I mean, that was a funny show, yeah?
It was out of control. It was like riding a tricycle with two wheels down a mountain road.
Yeah, there you go. So, actually, we don't have Gabriel yet this week, but he's going to be joining in 5 minutes. But we do have a special guest. So we've got Trevor Pott of... huge fame. Woo! Round of applause.
Yes.
Waits for the register, does a bunch of other things. Hello, Trevor.
Hello, guys. How are you?
Good, yeah.
Wow, that was quite a voice you just put on, Trevor. Is that like your official, like, Mr. Canada voice?
Hey, I got to be try to be polite sometimes.
I liked it. I thought it was great. We're glad to have you on. Thanks for coming on.
Absolutely, yeah. And you know what as well? There's no Rick this week either, so he's got a guest over from Europe that he's entertaining. So it's just the three of us for now, but we're probably going to have Gabriel in a little while. Now, before we get into anything that's like techie or of any interest, right, a couple of things, yeah. I want to give a shout out to the Tech Unplugged event that's coming up. If you're in Amsterdam on the 24th of September, there are still tickets available for Tech Unplugged in Amsterdam. I'm going to be there talking about deploying containers and applications into Amazon Web Services and all that kind of stuff. There's tons of other cool stuff going on. If you're in Amsterdam, 24th of September, get yourself registered for Tech Unplugged. Now.
No, I just want to say one thing about that.
Oh, yeah.
I think I'm going to be there.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. I don't have my tickets purchased yet, but I think I'm going to be over in the UK that week, and I think I'll make it down.
So let me just back up again. Scratch all of that. Avoid it like the plague. So
I might want to jump in just a little bit here before we get to the tech stuff too.
Shout.
So VMworld is coming up, and I think a lot of the listeners to this podcast are probably going to be going. One of the things that I want to just throw out there is that, you know, for people who are planning on going to VMworld, there are a whole bunch of really good contests that the vendors are putting on this year, that, you know, things like, they're giving away home labs, that sort of thing. So, you know, VM Turbo, Catalogic are the two ones that come to mind, but by no means the only ones. And some of these home labs are getting pretty ridiculous. Worth taking the time to go participate in these contests and, you know, visit them at the event, that sort of thing, to see if you can get one of those things. Also, there's a lot of parties that go on during the VMworld event. So what would be really cool, is to take a look at what parties you can get into, either the community-focused stuff or the stuff from the vendors, especially take a look at VM Underground, which have apparently removed the necessity of tickets this year as they've changed their sponsor setup and their locations. So it's worth everybody taking a bit of a look at those.
Trevor, is the VM Underground not going to be at the Thirsty Bear?
I don't honestly know where it is this year. I just remember having stumbled across some information about them not requiring tickets this year and them having a venue that can be populated by 1,000 people at a time, that it will be managed by the venue staff, not by the VM Underground staff. And so as people leave, more people will be let in, but they'll have to keep it within the 1,000 person limit as per fire regulations.
Cool. Hey, so have either of you guys done the Windows 10 upgrade yet?
Yeah.
Really?
I have an article on the Register about it. I went through the whole beta process from start to finish, and I maintain a system on Windows 10 just like I maintain an 8.1 and an 8 and a set and 7 and Vista and so forth. I mean, you can't really write about this stuff if you aren't in the process of using it. But Windows 10, as an operating system, is fantastic technology. Completely and utterly let down by some of the worst and most intrusive business decisions any technology company has made to date. And if it hadn't been for the ridiculous business decisions to basically force updates on everyone and spy on everyone, Windows 10 would have been amazing.
All right. Here's a story for you, right? So a while ago, the white little window flag came up in the bottom right-hand corner. Hey, do you want your free copy of Windows 10? I thought, yeah, why not? I mean, I do like to have shiny new toys and stuff like that. So I signed up for it. And about 3 days ago, I got the big message that said, hey, your upgrade's ready. And I'm like, oh, right. Well, this is actually like my work PC that I do everything on. So I just ignored it and I kept ignoring it. And it rebooted today and did like 40 updates. And when it came back on, there's this big message saying, next time you reboot, you're going to have Windows 10. And I'm like, you know what? I kind of wanted to test it on like a spare PC or a laptop or something first. So I'm now soiling my kegs that if the electricity goes off or if for any reason I have to reboot my PC, it's going to come back up with Windows 10 and like half my applications aren't going to work.
Oh, no. See, I wouldn't worry about that. If it does come back up with Windows 10, pretty much everything's going to work except maybe one or two video games
on
specific quirks of a driver somewhere. But no, if as long as you aren't one of those people that gets a random BSOD during the upgrade, it'll work.
Cool.
It'll work fine.
And I think actually from a conversation I've had on Twitter just like about 10 minutes ago, you can roll back pretty easily once you've done the upgrade. So I shouldn't be too scared, I guess. Hey, Gabriel, are you there?
I'm here.
Man, I couldn't hear any background noise, so I wasn't sure.
No, it's so crazy. My Skype completely flaked out on me. So if it isn't one thing, it's another.
I think he's been spying on us this whole time.
I think so, yeah.
I was on for a while, and I'm like, oh, man, Trevor's on there jibber-jabbing about, like, VM Underground, stuff like that, and then my Wi-Fi went, and then, you know, go figure.
Speaking of spying, you're not, like, running some Lenovo software there, are you, Gabriel?
Not today, no.
Okay, so there's a news article hot off the press apparently slamming Lenovo for, I don't know, Trevor, you're probably better at explaining it than me, but not giving a rat's arse about privacy and loading everything up with bloatware and spyware and crapware and stuff like that. Is that like a cultural thing because they're a Chinese company, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, because American companies never load their computers up with reams of crap.
Well,
that are security exploits.
You know what? I'm willing to put some money on the fact that if you went and started snooping around Dell's and other systems for pretty much the exact same sort of thing, you would find it. In this case, what happened was Lenovo put on a piece of software that's basically designed to let Lenovo manage your system, and they used a thing in the BIOS that is designed by Microsoft that allows them to inject this as a driver before the operating system boots. So even if you go and you Windows update and you replace the file in question with a newer version or a Microsoft version or just essentially a non-Lenovo version of this, the next time you reboot, it will re-inject the Lenovo version into your copy of Windows.
Yeah, so it is kind of screwy the way they do it. I'm reading about it right now, Trevor. They've got this thing called the LSE, Lenovo Service Engine, which is a piece of code on the motherboard. And that piece of code makes sure that Lenovo Check and Lenovo Update are on your system, and when they boot up, they just download shit to your machine.
Yeah, it's all, I mean, the idea sort of makes sense if you're looking at it from the standpoint of
the device manufacturer who wants to make sure that they can manage this fleet of systems that's going out to individuals who, quite frankly, probably do not know a great deal about how to run their computers. And it's sort of the Lenovo equivalent of Windows 10's forced updates. If you have one of these consumer-oriented Lenovo devices, it will make sure that you cannot remove the Lenovo software that allows Lenovo to update your system and or manage your system.
Well, that properly sucks, actually, that you can't remove it. Because, I mean, among probably the four of us, tell me if I'm wrong here, but so we've got two Lenovo laptops in the family. And it's not just Lenovo, right? My Samsung came with a bunch of pre-installed stuff. The first thing I do anytime I turn on a new laptop or get a new phone or anything is get rid of all of that bloatware.
Sure, but you are a technically competent individual.
I wouldn't go that far, but I know what you mean.
You at least do tech support for the home family, right?
Yeah, sadly, yeah.
Most of this stuff is really put in place there. And whether we're talking about a Lenovo or we're talking about a smartphone or whatever, it's put in place so that vendors have the smallest possible support surface to manage. And that really is their goal. And it makes perfect sense from a project management standpoint, even if it makes no sense from a privacy or a security standpoint.
So on privacy and security, is there anything about it that I should be really scared about? Like, is it going to nick my credit card details, or is it going to, like, I don't know, trawl my internet surfing history and expose it to the world, or anything like that?
It's unlikely. It just basically ensures that you have these other pieces of Lenovo crapware on there that basically themselves make sure that your system is up to date. I mean, from one perspective, that's a great thing if we're talking about, you know, Aunt Tilly, who is out there using her computer and thinks the internet is the big blue E. But it is a bit of a pain for technical users, which is probably why it never made it into things like the Think series of notebooks. If you have one of the notebooks aimed at more technical people, this just isn't on there.
Fair play.
But the thing that's interesting is that it is in firmware, right?
Yes.
The LSE is in firmware, and as far as I know, that's pretty hard to check on a system.
There's no excuse for it from a security standpoint. And, you know, don't mistake me for being a Lenovo apologist here at all. I would beat these guys black and blue with a salmon here if I could.
Okay. You
know, fish slap dance with Trevor Pott.
Let's use a carp or something. A fish that doesn't taste good.
But the thing is that at least it's understandable why they did it. And I think if we are ever going to combat this as an industry, if we're ever going to stand up against it and have a chance of explaining to the people who make these decisions why these decisions are bad, we have to understand why they're making these decisions in the first place.
That sounds like a whole load too much effort for me. I'm glad somebody else has to do that.
Yeah, that's my job, unfortunately.
Yes, and you do a grand job of it.
These days, though, you'd have to speak Mandarin to have that discussion, probably.
New project.
Actually, you know what? That's probably going to be a very important language to have going forward in the future, I reckon. Good grief. Not that I'm about to learn it or anything, but if I was going to learn a language now, that'd be pretty damn high on my list. Anyway, let's move on into our general, regular, like, enterprise tech news, okay? So we've just got two things for this week. First up, Gartner releases a Magic Quadrant for what it's calling integrated systems. I think that's converged infrastructure to you and me. But anyway, I reckon it was written by Gabriel because he just couldn't agree with it more than he does. I'll let him come on that one. I've got no idea how the local population and businesses are affected by this, right? But apparently on Monday, the whole of North Korea was without the internet for 4 hours. I mean, okay, I don't no idea how it affects North Korea, but can you imagine how that would affect you? 4 hours without the internet. Like, I think I'd have to sleep it out. I wouldn't know what to do.
But put yourself into the position of the average North Korean. Most North Koreans don't.
How do
have
I do it. That? Oh, well, yeah.
Most of them don't even have food, let alone the internet.
Well, go back.
Grass and rats.
Go back to the 1980s when You know, the internet was something that only a handful of people even knew was there, let alone had any access to. And most of it was used for academic purposes, you know, research purposes, military purposes. That's what the North Korean internet is like.
We're basically saying nobody over there will have batted an eyelid, probably, except for maybe a select few.
Yeah, but so that was probably caused by a counter-hacking attack by, you know, one of the Western governments, right? You know, so here's the problem, right? If they are, in fact, busy trying to hunt down rats and harvest grass, you know, cutting off their internet service for 4 hours probably doesn't create that much havoc for them.
Well, and also remember that North Korea is mostly an intranet, not the internet.
Yeah.
So a lot of their websites and a lot of the services that are provided by what we would consider to be the internet actually exist in a private address space in North Korea. So these guys, I mean, you could take out their pipe to the rest of the world, but you would not really affect their ability to get access to digital services that matter.
So do we know whether or not their intranet was down or their internet connection was down or what? What's the deal?
It looks like what happens is somebody took out their primary external connectivity provider, the one that was providing access essentially between North Korea and China.
Called China Unicom, not Unicorn, yeah. Unicom.
Oh, I like Unicorn so much better.
No, yeah.
Yeah, there doesn't appear to be any evidence that they took down any of the intranet services. So most North Koreans that had any access to what to them would be the internet, they wouldn't have even noticed.
Should we hit the Gartner Magic Quadrant then? So I just want to point out a few things just for any listeners that maybe haven't had a chance to see it, okay? I picked kind of like three things from it, right? Okay, so the leader looking at the Magic Quadrant to me, the guy's furthest out to the right and quite high up, it was Nutanix, okay? Love them or hate them, they were listed as having the most complete vision. Simplivity, another one that gets a lot of press at the moment. They were okay, right? But they were a little bit lacking on the execution front. So they were quite far to the right, but not very high to the top. And you know what? I think, didn't we just talk a couple of weeks ago about Simplivity saying that, you know, they'd lost their chief of sales and that Daron was taken over as head of sales again. And here we are. They're being, not slated on, but we're saying that they're lacking in the execution department. Fair play. You know what? The third point, though, IBM, they're in like the bottom left-hand corner, which I thought was pretty interesting. Now, that's like all just high-level stuff. Gabriel, I want to throw the ball to you because I know you don't necessarily think a great deal of this Magic Quadrant. Would that be fair?
I would think that most people that work in the, at least the hyper-converged industry, not ending in X with their name, think this is possibly the dumbest thing they've ever seen.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it looks like they just had a random company name generator spit out this stuff. What the, you know, I'm looking at this like, what industry is this that they're trying to focus on? It doesn't make any sense.
That's part of the problem, right? So if you actually get your hands on it and read through it, the market definitions, they're trying to lump too much stuff into one big chart because, I don't know, they're lazy, they don't know enough about it, there aren't enough players to make it compelling from a cost standpoint. I mean, this is the busiest Magic Quadrant I've ever seen in terms of number of people on it. What is it?
It's like the True Detective of Magic Quadrants. There's too many season plot
two,
items here.
Not one.
Yeah, season two. Season two. Yeah.
There's 19 companies on there.
19 companies on there. So what they listed is the integrated systems as a combination of server storage and networking infrastructure sold with management software that facilitates the provisioning and management of a combined unit. Okay. That kind of makes sense. Okay. But they're lumping server storage network hardware integrated with an application software. So that's going to put in like pure application systems, Oracle Exadata, Teradata stuff, those systems, which are kind of like purpose-built for specific apps, right? And then you get ones that are integrated systems, which is basically just converged infrastructure 1.0, vBlock, the HP converged systems, the Lenovo stuff, which is now, you know, formerly PureFlex and whatnot. And then you have hyper-converged, which is actually a better item in terms of what their original definition was. which is, you know, tightly coupled compute and network and storage. They should have, you know, they should, I think they should drop the integrated stack systems portion of it and just keep integrated infrastructure and hyperconverged as part of one, because I really don't think that the Oracle Exadata and the Pure App stuff, they just don't belong there. And it, like, people look at this and go, Teradata, what the F, right? They have no clue. But then if you start to actually look at the chart itself, it gets even more, you know, interesting, because now they're making changes. Last year it was Cisco and NetApp together for FlexPod. Now it's NetApp by itself and it's Cisco by itself. What are they counting as Cisco? Is it reference architectures? Because that's the only product that Cisco has. Yeah, EMC owns VBlock, you know?
Yeah, that's funny. Reference. Let's throw reference architectures in there too.
Well, that's what Cisco has to offer. And that's exactly what they've done. They've put that, and then there's players in there that you've never seen, and nobody's ever seen one of their boxes on the planet.
Yeah, but like that's why they're at the top of the axis for ability to execute, because it's just, you know, it's just vapor.
Or are they thinking that, you know, Cisco can execute because it's Cisco? I mean, because we look at the vapor? storage play that they did.
There are a few, you know, really big issues that I have with this too. So, I mean, you know, starting at that, you know, nobody's ever seen one of these boxes in the wild issue. You know, so let's go back. Gartner did a virtualization magic quadrant a little while ago that I have published a series of articles in the Register, just sort of tearing it up. One of the big things was that that magic quadrant had as a requirement to be listed, you have to have 100 customers, right? And, you know, they throw in Huawei and they say, oh, Huawei is a leader, and they're you know, doing well, and they belong in this
in
magic
China.
And fine, they are in China. But you know what?
How are they in North Korea?
How could you leave out? I mean, they're putting Huawei in there and saying they're there because they're doing really well selling OpenStack in BRICS countries, which is fair enough. But then how do you leave out HP and IBM from anything involving OpenStack? How do you leave out?
Right.
Ericsson, which is out there selling this stuff in droves to telecoms companies and so on and so forth. Like most of the companies that are doing OpenStack belonged on that magic quadrant. And here we have, you know, companies, you know, not to bash or diss them at all, but there's GridStore on this magic quadrant for integrated systems. And somehow a GridStore is considered more visionary than Scale Computing and way more visionary than IBM and somehow more than Huawei, but it doesn't even make any sense.
But less than Pivot3 and Nimbox and Dell.
Yeah. So then I read
Hitachi.
I guess I'll have to tell my buddy George Simmons, who runs GridStore, that he needs to spend more money with Gartner.
Well, I mean, at some point, this is the thing that everybody thinks when they think of Gartner. They think, well, whoever spent the most money gets to write their section. Because if you read the actual report, the analyst portions of it, oh my God, does it need some help?
Oh my God, exactly.
It calls out what SimpliVity is building off their strength in the VDI market. They've never positioned that system as a VDI market. If anything, they flipped Nutanix and SimpliVity in terms of the markets they initially went after. For me, it's completely legitimate to say Nutanix, building off the strength of their penetration into the VDI marketplace, has now moved into more enterprise class traditional infrastructure workloads. And I agree with where they sit in the quadrant to a certain extent. But yes, some of the things they said about some of the other people were completely like, did you even talk to anyone? Did you do any research at all?
Well, and the SimpliVity thing is one that really gets me, because it almost harkens back actually to a call that some analyst had with me when I was like half awake. They called me up at stupid o'clock in the morning, wouldn't tell me who they were working for, but wanted to pick my brain about hyperconvergence. And so, you know, they asked me a whole bunch of questions, and I very specifically remember saying, well, okay, if I was going to go out and deploy VDI, I would choose SimpliVity above everybody else because of that lovely little deduplication card of theirs and the fact that, you know, in reality, it works really, really well for VDI. And I remember, you know, being very specific about that, even though I know SimpliVity has not gone and pushed the VDI use case. it was one of the things that struck me a lot when I used the hardware. But when you actually, I mean, if you're going at this from an analyst standpoint and you're going, okay, so what are SimpliVity's use cases and what are they actually selling and what are people buying SimpliVity for? I mean, they're not buying SimpliVity in order to get VDI, not yet, because that's not what SimpliVity is selling it for.
It's
I think
CPU
that's
light.
What it's great for, but that's not what it's selling for. And you read this Magic Quadrant and it's like somebody took a couple of these conversations that they had with me at like stupid o'clock in the pre-coffee morning, completely out of context, chopped up a couple of pieces of them and threw them into a Magic Quadrant. And I, unfortunately, I can't discount
that.
It's a real possibility.
That's it, Trevor. That's it, Trevor. Yeah. They were channeling you at stupid o'clock pre-coffee. That's it.
Here's just the fun pro tip is always take your analyst calls after at least 5 lines of cocaine. There's no way you're going to not be awake. You'll talk faster. The call will go quicker, you know.
But don't take it with them because you'll only get half of the number of lines.
There is the voice of experience there. Hey, I have a question, right? So, you know, when Gartner are compiling all of these Magic Quadrants and things, like, where does a bunch of the information come from? Like, I want to know how much of it actually comes from just, you know, picking up the phone and calling the vendors and saying, so what percentage are you selling into this type of a market? And how many, I mean...
They'll sit in with the vendor for 8 hours, and the vendor will try to do a big presentation. But the problem is that the people Gartner are putting in front of these Magic Quadrants have absolutely no idea what any of this technology does. They've been away from the coalface for so long, they don't understand the technology they're spouting off about. They don't test it. They don't use it in production. They don't know what they're talking about. And so they will also, in addition to talking to the vendors, call up some of the well-known analysts and bloggers, and then where the real thing comes in is that they have a couple of captive Fortune 500 or Fortune 2000 companies that they then go to and get some advice about, oh, well, what are you using this for and what do you think? And then they mash it all together and through some magical process that I think involves hitting themselves over the head, are the, you know, significant chunks of information to put in their MQ. But it doesn't make any rational sense if you actually know the environment that we're talking about.
I think it's also like hard, though.
The what was just expressed came from the mouth of Trevor Pott. Do not necessarily reflect the hosts of the show.
I was thinking they, you know, looking at some of this and from the conversation we've just had there, they must be like smoking something when they put these things together. But, you know, genuinely, from what we've said there, it's far from a bulletproof way of putting, you know, solid, I don't want to say solid research.
I always want to go back and look at who did the analysis. You know, sometimes you get people there who have recently spent times in the relevant space. And then there are times you get people that have, I'm like, dude, really? George Weiss has been at Gartner for over 30 years.
Away from the coalface, like Trevor was saying.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, and I'm not trying to impugn them. These people are smart. They get paid a lot of money. And
paid more than me.
Work that they do. But the thing is, it's like, I mean, dude, seriously? I mean, 30 years ago, I mean, he's never even seen a storage array or touched one. And he's going to do, you know, he's going to cover servers and storage. Somebody who's been that far away from it from an actual hands-on perspective. And, you know, maybe I'm completely off base here. And he's spent the last, you know, he's got a Jason Bakke-esque home lab in his garage. But, you know, it's, I think that they need to freshen up some of the people and call out some more diverse voices. I understand going to the Fortune 2000 and seeing where they think those people are going. But you know what? Those are like the, you know, the least, early adopter type companies on the planet. They are at the tail end of the adoption curve. Most of them are running mission critical systems that are still running big iron. I mean, that's the Z space, right?
OS2.
To an extent.
I think if you're Gartner, considering what Gartner charges everybody, they should have enough money to basically pay two sets of analysts for each Magic Quadrant. One set of analysts can do the Magic Quadrant this year, while the second set is busy training and learning and doing hands-on work. And then, you know, that set of analysts will write the next year's Magic Quadrant and so on and so forth. And this way they can keep their analysts fresh and they can keep their analysts up to date and actually knowing, you know, what the storage is and the servers and the whatever internet of software-defined pornography. Who cares?
No, Trevor, they should have the two sets of analysts and put them in two separate rooms and get them both to work on the same Magic Quadrant and see if either of the Magic Quadrants that they come out with at the end look remotely like the other one.
I'm just looking through the list of people who did this, and almost all of them have like 15 to 20 years at Gartner. You're so far away from the actual pulse of what's happening. You go out and talk to a lot of companies. You talk to a lot of these guys. They feed you information. But I just, you know, and then you have your Gartner event once or twice a year, and everybody woos you and everybody sucks up to you. But I don't think that you're really doing the kind of an analysis that, you know, that breaks it apart from a technical standpoint. You look at the Magic Quadrant, and it's not something that I would use to validate a technology based on its capabilities. It's just geared towards such a different group. You know, it's geared towards these, you know, the C-suite. For lack of a better term.
This is why whenever I'm trying to do anything that might remotely seem analyst-y, I rather enjoy dealing with people like you, Gabe, because you will tell me when I am talking bullshit and saying something stupid, and you will make no bones about it. And I think there aren't a lot of people willing to do that to Gartner. And I think that's the problem. If Gartner says something stupid, they're like, "Oh no, we can't badmouth Gartner. They might put us in a bad place on the Magic."
Oh no! There are people that shake down Gartner every day. Oh, are you kidding? The analyst relations people that work for some of these big companies that Gartner has on them.
It's K Street.
That's not all white glove relationship. Believe me.
I mean, I'm willing to give everybody the benefit of the doubt here. I just think this particular Magic Quadrant kind of blows. I would like to see it broken apart a little bit and a little more specialized. You know, there are enough players in this space to actually have a plain hyper-converged infrastructure Magic Quadrant, and that would be a lot more and then spend more time on the use cases and more time on the value proposition and where people are actually buying these. And where they are implementing them. And I think there's more value in that other than just kind of doing a real high level one page Hoover's analysis of the company.
Yeah, so I think the last time I was on a call with Gartner doing this kind of preparation for a Magic Quadrant, I was working for Microsoft and we were talking to someone that was reviewing cloud services. And I was on a call with them, and I've got to say, I thought that the number of questions, the depth of the questions, the thoroughness that they wanted to dig into them was actually pretty blasted impressive. Right.
Yes.
And it was a really good dialogue. So I feel wrong about throwing Gartner under the bus. I think something went wrong with this Magic Quadrant, but I'll say not all of them are that way. And some of them are actually pretty representative. This one I think is just a mistake.
I'm just saying, hey, you know what? I mean, just to move on. I mean, it's like, I think we're kind of beating this one to death, mm-hmm. but you know, I mean, it is a 6-month process to do Gartner traditionally. Like if you're going to do it, they start back at a certain point. They do all their analysis, and let's be frank, especially in this industry, things can change immensely in 6 months. From the time that they started doing their analysis to the time that the study is actually published, companies go out of business. They usually don't make it onto the the quadrant, but you know, great things can happen and bad things can happen, and companies get purchased and whatnot. And it's hard to take something in this particular space, especially. And, have it elongate for such a period where they're doing their analysis. Now, on the flip side of that, it's probably impossible to do this in real time. And maybe they should have a something that's a little more of a living document than just such a static snapshot at a period of time.
That's interesting. That is interesting.
I think that one of the things to be added to that is, there was mention there that if you took two different groups of Gartner analysts and lock them in a room, they would come up with two completely different Magic Quadrants.
Well, not completely, but yeah.
I don't actually know about that. See, much as Mark said, and I have to agree with him, having been on a couple of calls with Gartner, they do ask a lot of questions. And in many cases, they ask many of the right questions. And it seems to be that the newer the market segment, the more unlikely it is that they will ask enough of the right questions. And so I think what it is that Gartner is actually pretty good when it comes to creating the processes and the right set of questions and having what they're going to analyze and how defined for anything that's been around for long enough. But something that's new or that includes very new concepts like hyperconvergence, they still haven't shaken out how they're going to analyze these markets or how they're going to deal with the really rapid iteration of change. And I guess that's where I really would like to see people who have a lot more hands-on experience being really involved in it, because they could help define what the questions are and what the analysis process needs to be so that it comes up with something that's maybe more reflective of these newer market segments and how they are changing and interacting with our data centers.
Cool. Okay, gents, I need to just jump in there. We're flogging it to death. Let's shift on to biz news, right? There's a lot going on in the biz section this week as well. So front and center, we've got Google are busting some moves, forming a new holding company called Alphabet. Basically, I think breaking up the existing business into multiple independent businesses, so each with its own CEO and the likes. And apparently, and I'm not surprised about this if it is the case, but it's nothing to do with the situation in the EU. Away from Google, Pure Storage announces its intent to IPO. Semantic blindly robs the Carlyle Group of $8 billion and rubs salt in the wound by crapping on the lawn and leaving Veritas behind for them. And finally, HP splits operationally. Though actually, you know what? I'm not sure if they actually have split yet or if they're going to split later this month. The story was just too boring for me to read, but it's going to be happening soon. HP is either, they're either split or they're about to split. Now, any of those jump out to anybody as like something you really want to talk about?
The Google Alphabet thing was something that I sort of have been noodling about here a little. There's, you know, this discussion that, you know, it's not going to prevent the EU from poking its nose in there, etc. And I'm not sure that I buy that line. I think it won't prevent the EU from investigating Google, but that doesn't necessarily mean that Alphabet itself has to have a presence anywhere in the EU. And if all of Google's assets, the large buckets of money, get passed up to Alphabet, what can the EU do to get access to it? I mean, they can go and they can fine Google, the entity, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they can fine Alphabet and or any of its, you know, the other subsidiaries that have been hived off.
Actually, I think lawyers in the EU can do whatever they want in that case.
Yeah, I won't profess to be an expert on it. I think they can levy fines however they want. It's actually collecting the fines that's probably the challenge. I'm sure they can levy them against the parent company, but you know whether they actually pay up or not, I don't know.
I just figured this was a new tax dodge.
Oh, I don't doubt that. Yeah, I mean, of course.
But what does it say about the rest of the planet? You know, what about Kanji? Poor Japanese. Now I guess they just don't exist if Alphabet's what where it's at. I mean,
you know what? How much do you think they spent trying to come up with the name of that? It had to be huge.
You know, I
come
mean,
up with Alphabet.
I mean, I hope that was some. They were like sitting around, you know, drinking
at
some organic chai tea latte, yeah. You know, in Boulder or whatever the hell they were to come up with a name as a lark. You know, it's just like a goof. I mean, I wouldn't put it past them. It might be something, you know, they're really known for subtle inside jokes. And, you know, when you got more money than baby Jesus, what does it matter what your company's called?
You got to get the geography right. It was a big sit-in at Shoreline Amphitheater right over there in Mountain View. Where all the Google offices are. They probably packed it in and, you know, had a moment.
Apparently, they made it past the wall to get back into San Francisco to do this. So.
Very good, yeah.
No, they were purely outside the wall.
You know, around the name of the company, though, so the web URL is abc.xyz or .xyz, I suppose. But if you go to abc.wtf or abc.fail or anything, or a bunch of others, it takes you straight to Bing, which...
Are you kidding?
No, I'm totally serious. You can do it now.
Oh, my gosh. Who do you think did that? Oh, my gosh.
And the rumor is that Microsoft has registered those domain names, but, you know, I'm sure they haven't. Who knows, though?
Yeah. Socket's last stand, Bing.
Yeah.
I think it is interesting. I saw that Bloomberg had an article last week that talked about their problems in Europe and, you know, how the regulators there are, you know, regulators there are really clamping down on what's best for the consumer. And it's, not what's best for the consumer, what's best for fair business practice, right? In the U.S., it's a matter of what's good for the consumer, but in Europe, it's a case what's good for fair business practice. And it's a really interesting article. I just recommend people look it up. You can Google Bloomberg Europe and you'll find it. And it's a long read, but a really good one.
What do you have any thoughts that you can summarize on the whole situation there then, Mark?
Google misinterpreted the gentleman that was leading for the EU, the Spanish guy, who thought he had it in the bag, and then this firebrand, this lady, attorney, she got a hold of it and just would not let it go, and she's smart, and she's making her career with this. And maybe she already had one, but she's ferocious. And just understanding this on a personal level, you know, you kind of schmooze people there, you think you're okay, and then somebody else comes in and they attack you like a junkyard dog. And that's what she's doing. And I don't mean junkyard, I don't mean to demean her that way. You know, she's looking out for small businesses and large businesses both. The other thing that was interesting about it was the publisher in Germany that was able to show damage to his ability to get people to his sites based on how Google was ranking searches. And they were able to demonstrate Google's search rankings, you know, were screwing them. And it's like, Google, really? How did you let it come to that? But, you know, it's a big company. Lots of people work there. And I think they're in trouble there. I think Google's in trouble in Europe.
There's a big push in, or I shouldn't say a big one. There's a very notable push within the European Union to split the search engine from the rest of the business. And I mean, it was put forth as, okay, this would theoretically affect all search providers or at least all the big ones. But I mean, it was clearly very aimed at Google. I've been reading about people talking about this, about breaking up Google and splitting off search for some time. I mean, it keeps coming back up. It's a repetitive meme, but I just do not for the life of me understand.
Okay, so here's the thing, right?
Does the search engine survive without a source of revenue?
Well, you know, there's all kinds of ads that you show. So there's AdWords, and then there's search criteria, and then there's search results, right? So you can show ads, but then you've also got search results. So say you're a small business or even a medium-sized business, and this is been, you know, shown in cases in this case, somebody that used to get, you know, hits at the top. Well, Google changes, you know, Google, you know, just says, well, we're going to change our criteria for the kind of results that we give. But actually, then what happens is Google business entities start showing up in front of their own, right? And Google saying, well, you can just scroll down or go to the next page. Well, whoever does that, mm-hmm. right? It's those hits at the top that get all the business. And Google has been injecting their own businesses there. Right. And they already make the money off of AdWords, and they are a monopoly. That's the thing.
I understand the complaint. What I don't understand is if you separate the Google search business from the Google advertising business and you pull basically Google search out of the whole rest of the Google organization, how does the search component as a completely separate entity survive? There's no revenue in just providing.
No, AdWords is still there. AdWords is still there, Trevor. Google search and AdWords would still exist, and they would print money.
That's not what they're proposing. They're proposing very specifically and very explicitly hiving off search from advertising.
But what has happened, or what is happening with Alphabet here, right, is that they're breaking out core And as far as I understand, Core is search, ads, maps, and videos, like, I guess, YouTube, yeah? And then other things that are non-core, like Google X, so like cars, space, Google Glass, Nest, and health, and stuff like that, all separate. But the thing is, they all send their money, their profits and things effectively back to Alphabet, at least the way I understand it, right? And then Alphabet decides, right, well, we can invest that money back into search, or we can buy a company, or I think that's my understanding, at least, of how it works. So, you know, with Alphabet, they're not putting search out on its own, but theoretically, I think they could, and it could still survive because adverts and whatever else that is generating revenue, like it's growing on trees, right? All goes back to Alphabet, and Alphabet can say, right, well, we'll plow that back into search. That would still work, I think. Should we switch gears slightly to Pure Storage look into IPO, right? So I had a look on Crunchbase earlier. They've raised, I counted it to be $470 million in like six rounds of funding. They've announced their intent to IPO, and the number $3 billion, I mean, $3 billion, good grief, is being thrown around. What have they got, actually? Like, what have they got that's worth $1 billion, $2 billion, never mind $3
billion? You know, I mean, they got an all-flash array. I'll be mindful of how I discuss this, because I think it's, you know, I work for a competitor, so I don't want to be like that guy. I do think that most of what I read today was much more focused on Barron's analysis of, you know, what Pure's S-1 statement said. And we could put that link in the show notes. And I thought that that was interesting. You know, they spent a lot of money. And I think that their revenues weren't up to, you know, I think they were outside the limits that people were initially thinking they were at by a pretty good margin. And they're spending, you know, if you dig into the S-1, there's a lot of money they spent on the R&D because, you know, they have a new platform that they're working on. So, you know, that makes sense. But for the most part, you know, it's we knew a couple companies were going to IPO this year. It's a big step to take a company to public. And so, you know, we can give them a congrats on that, because it's definitely not something that we see a lot of in the storage world. In fact, you know, in the last 3-4 years, we've seen three companies do it. So, you know, it's a big accomplishment. It's a vision that many founders don't get to realize.
Yeah.
So I posted on this on the Tejal blog today, and I the same thing, right? A big congratulations to the folks at Pure. To some degree, they are lifting everybody else in this business right now. And you know, the life is short, and you work in different places with people, and then you move on. And I've got good friends working inside Pure, and I just don't resent this at all. I hope they have great success, prolonged success. When we compete against them, I hope we succeed. But for the flash part of the industry, you know, that Gabriel and I are in, this is a big thing. And I hope it goes very well for them. And I mean, it'll bode well for us. So, I mean, you know, it's an interesting thing, me saying this here, because, you know, it could be a time to, like, you know, dig on Pure or bash on them or something. But instead, it's more like, go flash industry. I mean, my bias is more towards, you know, wanting to see them succeed than wanting to, you know, than being snarky.
That's good of you. But my issue is just the number $3 billion that keeps getting bandied around. I mean, it's just a huge number. I can't get my head around that.
Yes and no. I mean, one of the things that you have to bear in mind about Pure, and I mean, let's put any of the discussions about the technology to one side for a second here. They have mindshare, and they have mindshare with a lot of the right people in a lot of the right places. Much like Nutanix, Pure have done a really good job of beating up social media and hitting all of the community events, getting embedded in enterprises, getting CXO mindshare. When people think about, you know, all-flash storage, Pure is probably the number one name that comes to mind. And the fact that they succeeded at that, that actually is worth a huge, huge, huge amount, because name recognition, especially amongst the CXO brand that doesn't, that rely on Gartner for their vision of what is going on, that buys a lot, and it legitimately is worth
billions of dollars on its own.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be worth much if there wasn't like a big motivation for, you know, these people to think why it's such a huge opportunity. And this gets back to the technology, right? It's about acceleration and transformation. It's about whole different kinds of apps. It's about, you know, it's about new ways of thinking about things. It's about not accepting any weight whatsoever. You know, it's about getting that answer right away when you ask a question to your phone, you know, or you look for something somewhere. You know, it's about instantaneous access to huge amounts of data. It's about running analytics, you know, for the Internet of Things. It's about all of the change that's going on in transformation. There's no doubt that flash storage or whatever the follow-on for memory is going to be there. It goes, I mean, it is a huge, huge shift in the capability to process large amounts of data. And people see that. And people see that, and Pure is at the pinnacle of where storage is in this thing, and that's why they get that valuation.
I think it's part of it, but I think the other side of this is there are a lot of good companies with great technology that will never see that $3 billion number, that will never see an IPO, much as was discussed, especially in storage. It doesn't happen very often because even though the technology is great, either the execution is lacking or the marketing and gaining the mind share just doesn't happen. You have to have it all. You have to be able to.
Totally.
Well, there are advantages.
It's a fairly competitive space. Yeah, first movers have a huge advantage, and you see that. You know, look at the other Gartner Magic Quadrant we talked about with Nutanix in the hyperconverged space. First mover has a massive advantage, especially if the company knows how to market, knows how to execute, and can sustain it. And we've seen lots of companies have, you know, stumbling blocks, but that first mover advantage completely eliminates all of it. And so, you know, being first to market, being that thought leader or the trailblazer or whatever you want to call it, is such a big deal. It's really hard to quantify it fully, but you know, it is pretty amazing what they're able to do.
Agreed. Guys, can we wind things out then with any comments, if anybody has any, on the Carlyle Group spending what I just think is an insane number, okay? $8 billion on, I could be totally wrong here, right? And you know what, I usually am, right? But on a legacy storage management software in Veritas, right? Don't get me wrong, it's rock solid software and used it a lot in the past. You know, it's especially solid on some of the Unix platforms and things. But how much of a future does it have, really? I mean, it really feels like a legacy product to me, or a legacy portfolio predominantly, and $8 billion ain't cheap.
$8 billion for Veritas?
That's what I think, yeah. That's what I read, yeah.
It's only about a Skype's worth.
Did they get a brick of, I mean, like a vault full of gold with it, too?
Yeah, well.
I mean, I'd be curious to see what it was structured, you know, in terms of, you know, if there was a huge patent portfolio that came with it, if there was, you know, some other lines of business or assets that came along with, in terms of physical capital, because I wouldn't think that Veritas, the storage product, was worth $1 billion, let alone eight.
Yeah. Well,
I know I'm going to regret saying this, but did Kraftwerk have anything to do with this?
that one with a K, yeah?
That's right.
And an E.
Yeah,
Kraftwerk. Black sweaters.
Who knows?
What is Veritas's business anymore, right? Is it all backup? They've got Enterprise Vault, Symantecs, Enterprise Vault. What else do they have? What's their business? What do they generate revenue from?
I don't know. They've got like the whole Veritas Volume Manager and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. There's, what do they call them? There's net backup.
Yeah, Net Backup and Enterprise Vault. I can't imagine that Volume Manager makes any money for them anymore.
I mean, it is less visible than the Barracuda Networks appliances that I see in every airport.
Yeah.
So I remember back in the day, right? You used to be able to walk through airports and you would see big banners for Veritas, right? This was before the sale to Symantec, and they had a presence, and everybody knew they were a powerful company. And it just seems that the whole time at Symantec has been marching in the wrong direction the whole time. I really don't know what went on there, what happened. My guess is, you know, leadership leadership just went away. When that company was run by Mark Leslie, it was great. That was a great company. And after Gary Bloom, who had left Oracle to come in and run it, I think he just turned it into crap. And it's just been going there. And $8 billion, it's a lot of money to Symantec. And I just, it's a hard, you know, we're sitting here trying to think, what products do they have? Is it worth $8 billion if those of us that are in the industry can't even think of their products?
You know what, as well, I've just Googled it here. So in 2004, Symantec buys Veritas for $13.5 billion.
Yep.
So, oh, that's a drop of, what, $5.5 billion there?
Not even factoring in inflation.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I don't know whether they're selling the whole shebang that they bought off to the Carlyle Group. I really don't know, but still a big number. Good grief. Well, there you go. Well, thank you, everybody, for being on the show. Trevor, thank you for being our guest this week. Round of applause, I think. Woo!
Yay!
Yay! Hey, thanks. Thanks for coming on, Trevor. It's been great having you.
And, gents, on the topic of the VDB takeover last week, so, Gabriel, you're lining up another episode with the VDB guys, yeah?
We're going to do a live episode during Monday at VMworld in the V Brown Bag Hang Space place. I'm sure the VDB will be there. And the sound quality should be good because we're actually using professional equipment, unlike the things I use in a normal day-to-day basis.
We all know about that.
So where's this going on? I'll be like running around. Gabriel, I want to be in on this.
It's at it'll be at Moscone. I'll get you the deets, the 411, and as far as I can tell right now, it looks like many of the original crew who were on last time will be on. We may have one or two more. Peter Chang, Jason Langer, Tim Antanowitz, Conrad Ramos, Mike Preston, and if he can make it, as well as Damon Carlson and myself. So it'll be a pretty good group of people. I would expect that show to be highly irrelevant. irrelevant. We may even go over
and
one
irreverent.
Or two technical items. Yeah, irrelevant and irreverent. I'm sure it'll be both of those things. But I wanted to impart the feedback I got from the guys that did the show last week that they had a lot of fun doing it. It was one of the goofier shows we had in a while. So thanks.
Oh, it's the best show we've done, I think. It was great. And I use we very loosely because I wasn't on it, but yeah.